All right, everybody. Ha, ha, ha. Ho, ho, ho. He, he, he. Ha, ha, ha. Ho, ho, ho. He, he, he. Ha, ha, ha. Ho, ho, ho. He, he, he. Ha, ha, ha. Ho, ho, ho. He, he, he. Ha, ha, ha.
Welcome to Science Questions. I'm Susie Montgomery.
And I'm Sherry Quinn.
So does everybody feel a little better now?
You just heard a laughing class put on by a group called Fresh Start, an organization overseen by Valley Mental Health. That was how the class, Happiness 101, started. And Ralph teaches about a dozen psychiatric patients twice a week how laughter is the best medicine. Valley Mental Health manages almost all mental health care across Salt Lake, Tooele, and Summit counties, from people with serious mental illnesses like schizophrenia and bipolar patients, to people with substance abuse disorders and behavioral problems like obsessive compulsive disorder and depression.
Valley Mental Health has been the major and almost only mental health care provider across the Wasatch Front for the past two decades. It was this not-for-profit entity that held the Medicaid contract issued by the state of Utah, who prepaid them yearly to assess, manage, and distribute basically all the funds allocated to helping the mentally ill. And they were recently dethroned by a multi-billion dollar health insurance company called United Health Group, who manages a subsidiary called Optum, who now calls the shots. In a two-part series, SQ Radio reports on what's being referred to as a crisis in mental health care. It started at the end of 2011 and is still a rough transition because Valley Mental Health was a Goliath that no one thought would ever fall.
Many of the folks that won't be with us after the first of the year have been with us for many years.
Valley Mental Health has announced the layoffs of up to 125 employees. How will that affect the services the agency provides? Good evening. Valley Mental Health employees whose jobs will be cut will find out December 1st. Their last day on the payroll will be December 31st.
The news comes with the announcement of a major reconfiguration of how people will be treated by the agency. Sarah Dolph is live in Salt Lake with the details. Sarah, what's going on?
Well, Bruce and Deanie, what do you do when you provide a critical service to the community yet are looking at less and less funding? Well, Valley Mental Health is changing the way it provides treatment services. It hopes this will mean continued service for its patient load of 20,000 people. But if the funding doesn't pick up anytime soon, they say more cuts will have to be made.
We're facing an impending sort of tragic situation for a lot of patients.
That is clinical psychiatrist Dr. Noel Gardner. He recently resigned from Valley Mental Health, along with a large number of his fellow clinicians, who have also left in the last several months. He explains why.
The centerpiece of that process was a deep sense of responsibility for patients who are highly vulnerable, and also a strong sense of camaraderie with our colleagues, nurses, social workers, therapists, caseworkers, that we work as a team trying to provide these services. And it felt like abandoning people you care deeply about. So, you know, I think many of us stayed long beyond the time we felt that it was healthy or good for us to do.
Dr. Gardner says the deal breaker was the micromanagement of the encounters the clinicians had with their patients, where administrators prioritized mass production efficiency rather than putting the patient first.
It began to feel like every person was simply a source of information to be generated into the electronic record. And increasingly, we were told that we had to see more and more patients in less and less time with more and more data collection, to the point that 80-85% of our time was computer FaceTime, and 10-15-20% of our time was patient face-to-face time.
And the computer work was stacking up.
And what was so sad for us was that it wasn't very useful information. It felt like we were simply generating documentation to make it appear like we were providing the care, when in fact the care itself, we were providing some of it, but it was so drained of the personal element that is essential to good quality care that it felt meaningless to do it. Now, I understand that people felt the obligation to bring these to bear. There were requirements for reporting certain things, but the whole bureaucratic attempt to bring efficiencies the process had become so removed from the clinical reality that what we were doing no longer made sense. And it felt like there was huge liability. That is, we were not adequately able to engage the patient, get sufficient information to feel confident in the decision-making necessary within the time frames that were being required, that it felt like we were carrying the medical legal liability for people in decision-making, that we just simply didn't have the time to make good decisions and still meet all the requirements that were being placed upon us.
All the other kids better run, run, run. Run, run, back to the shadow.
I am walking into a downtown Salt Lake City pharmacy with who we are calling BH. He's an old friend and who wishes to remain anonymous and is currently a patient at Valley Mental Health.
I need to pick up the refill.
Well, I'm picking up antipsychotic medication because it's the same Walgreens that I pick up my antipsychotic medication from Valley Mental Health.
And what's your experience been like with Valley Mental Health?
Well, they're somewhat accommodating. My therapist came downstairs because I wasn't able to climb upstairs, even though his office was upstairs. But they don't have any psychiatrists that I get to see, so it's an RN that prescribes my medication for me. The RN was just, you know, going through the different possible antipsychotic medications, and he basically let me pick what medication I wanted, because the previous antipsychotic medication had my legs kicking. I was having spasms, and originally picked, I think it was Abilify for me. This is the one I had the problem with, and I just recently chose olanzapine as my drug of choice. I've had a psychologist that's a licensed psychologist, but I've never seen a psychiatrist at all at Valley Mental Health.
Do you find it takes longer now to get appointments, prescriptions? Anything like that?
I don't think it really takes longer to get those things. I mean, they schedule everything. It's just that the access to a psychiatrist is impossible. I feel like I'm getting less care than maybe what I need. So that's a little sad. And, you know, I guess the times to get in to see a psychologist are fewer and more far between. I was told that I couldn't see one anyway if I wanted to, and that's a bit of a bummer. I don't know. I mean, the therapist was a good therapist, but it just seemed like he was running out of advice to give. When he ran out of it, he just kind of kept reiterating what he was saying before, so I don't know. I grade the whole thing at you know, a C-minus experience, but I don't really have any other locations to compare it with. All the other kids with the phone.
So it's not so much that I feel like these are bad people. I think their intentions were good. But mental health treatment is a very personal thing. And it takes time, and it takes relationship, and it takes communication. And it felt like we had begun to exist for the purpose of generating documentation, for the purpose of billing, and that the patients were really grist for that, rather than that the entire administration was in the service of providing us the opportunity to do sufficient care, personal care, that was really quality for the patients. In many ways, healthcare has been hijacked, in a sense, by a set of sort of corporate, and it's not just sort of profit or cost savings. It is this idea that quality care will do sort of the exact same thing with every patient. And now, if you're building Toyotas, you want to have very precise, consistent systems so that those cars are put together in a very precise, exactly the same way every time, so they come off with this kind of perfection. The problem is, when you're dealing with people, every person is unique. I mean, and it's we're not treating diseases, we're treating persons. And even if they share the same diagnosis, that diagnosis is completely a different entity in one individual than it is in another. And the kind of relationship you form takes unique personal skills to make that therapeutic experience work. It takes trusting the clinician to do the work. We need to reclaim a sense of the professional trust. That is, these are people who are trained with extensive clinical experience to do this kind of work. Now we need to trust them to do that, rather than to try to micromanage every bit of the data, every bit of the processes, to turn people into Toyotas coming off an assembly line so that we can bill for that chunk of service, collect the revenue. There is this kind of delusional thinking that somehow that is quality improvement in healthcare, and it's not quality improvement.
At the pharmacy called Apothecary, where the main clientele are patients with behavioral health disorders on Medicaid, pharmacist and owner Kevin DeMoss is dispensing drugs the new way.
This is it's an AutoMed fast fill automatic dispensing system. And then it's just like a great big battleship game, like I-9 and A-4. And then it tells us where their prescription's gonna fall out of.
DeMoss is upset. He sees patients every day coming in, unable to fill their prescriptions because now they can't get in fast enough to see their doctors. Doctors who are overwhelmed, stretched thin, because of major cutbacks, and now Optum, who's taken over the contract, has a very different management style, throwing yet another curveball into the field.
Patients establish a relationship with their caregiver, whether it's their medical doctor, their psychiatrist, their psychologist, their nurse, their repayee, their therapist, their social worker, their dentist, their pharmacist. Each one of these patients who deliver that service, that fee for service, there's a relationship developed between that patient and that provider, all the way down to the pharmacy. And when that is eliminated or disrupted in any way, oftentimes the patients are going to find another provider if they're able. They're going to find another provider that they're comfortable with, that they can share their intimacies with, that they can share their fears with, and their anxieties or their aggressions or their feelings. It's very difficult to go in and establish that visit after visit after visit with a new provider, with someone you've never seen before. They're the most timid, they're the most vulnerable of any of the patient populations that we deal with. They're the less stable of all, and they need the most care. That's why it's so critical that they can have that relationship with their provider, because it helps them to maintain the dignity and their operating level that they've been accustomed to. Every day, we talk about it all day long. Where are you at? How's your anxiety? How's your aggression? How are you doing with your agitation? Are you taking your meds? Are you taking them with food? Are you taking them at night? We go through and we plan every patient's medication management system for them so that they can have the very, very best outcome. And then when I don't see my patients, they're left to do it on their own. And they can't.
This has been happening in healthcare, all of healthcare, for the last couple of decades. So it's not unique to mental health or to Valley. I think it was accelerated by the coming Optum contract and the implications of it. And internally, Valley tried to accommodate to those expected sort of changes with strategies that have made it harder and harder for clinicians to do their work. Increasingly, and that's what happened in my world, I found myself with doctors and advanced practice nurses having left. These people who are on antipsychotic medications need their medications refilled. I have no place to put them in my schedule. I already have my patient load. So I'm signing off refills of medications for large numbers of people who I've never seen, which we're always told don't be prescribing and managing people you've never examined and know nothing about.
Basically, there's nothing for my symptoms. If I have symptoms or I feel like I'm having an episode, I can call and arrange an appointment. But that's anywhere from, 4 days to a few weeks out to see anyone. And so it's not an emergency room style operation. And that's just to see my psychiatrist. But I mean, I could always arrange to go see the guy again, because he only is giving me 5 minutes of his time before he's prescribing me pills. So I think the pressure's on him to push people through like a cattle farm.
This is a crisis point. We need to sit down and rethink where we're at, because just simply acting like everything is normal is not going to solve a problem that is waiting for a major tragedy.
Pharmacist DeMoss recalls one of these critical incidents where he witnessed one of his female patients in his pharmacy heading down that volatile path.
So she came in and talked to me on a Saturday, and she was very, very concerned that she was going to run out of her medication before her doctor's appointment. And she knew that in the back of her mind that was going to precipitate an emergency room visit and possibly a hospital an admit for her. So if she was left without this very important medication for the 5 to 7 day gap before she got in to see her doctor, she knew in her heart and in her mind that she was convinced that she would relapse and end up in the hospital.
And consequences in the emergency room at the University of Utah Hospital are also apparent to Dr. Troy Madsen, Research Director in Emergency Medicine.
I definitely have seen an increase in the number of patients we see with psychiatric issues or psychiatric complaints. That's been my experience, and it also is supported by looking at some of the numbers over the last few years, where it has increased over the last couple of years by about, maybe about 7%. In terms of the psychiatric patients, they make up about probably 7 or 8% of the patients that we do see in the ER. So it's a pretty good chunk when you figure one out of, every 10 or 15 patients you see is going to be there for some kind of a psychiatric reason. That may be in part because we do work closely with UNI, with the University Neuropsychiatric Institute. And so we do a lot of kind of working with them, screening patients for them. I think that's probably a big contributor to the large percentage of psychiatric patients we see. But I have definitely seen those numbers go up in the last few years.
It seems that this healthcare crisis has a tremendous ripple effect, overflowing into our streets and infiltrating our social programs, hospitals, and even the jails.
We need a mechanism for rethinking mental health care in which the severe, persistent mentally ill are the first priority, and that we take care of that population. If we don't, many of them will become homeless. They'll be in jails because they often unintentionally commit crimes. They're caught loitering, breaking and entering. Sometimes they will become paranoid and commit serious crimes. And I do a fair amount of forensic expert witness work on criminal cases. It's a great tragedy that these people end up often in the criminal justice world.
We used to always talk about how the biggest psychiatric hospital in the state is in the jail and the prison. Basically, little psychiatric hospitals inside of all the jails and prisons in every county in this state and around the country.
That was Trent Holmberg, the former director of psychiatric services at Salt Lake County Jail, who now has a private practice as a psychiatrist. The job at the jail just got too tough.
When we do treat people once they're incarcerated, it's kind of with a half-hearted effort in terms of the the financial support to back that kind of an effort, because it's a Herculean task to treat, you know, hundreds of thousands of mentally ill people in jails and prisons around the country.
And it is really expensive to buy the necessary drugs for these patients, roughly $50,000 per month, and that's bare bones for these highly specialized drugs.
It's really reaping what was sown a few generations ago when the insane asylums became state hospitals, and the state hospitals became criticized as being a place to warehouse mentally ill people.
I am amazed at how few people really understand the history of community mental health and the history of the development of psychiatry, including the top leadership of each of these organizations, who I think largely have sort of accepted the way things are and don't always fully appreciate sort of the context. So let me just say a couple of things that are essential to understand. Community mental health is a product of some things that happened way back over 50, 60 years ago. That is, prior to about the early 1960s, mid-50s, early 60s, psychiatric care for this population was done in state hospitals. These are people for whom there was no treatment. The very first antipsychotic medication that allowed the quieting of all of these hallucinations and voices and the severe agitation, the very first antipsychotic became available in the United States in 1954. Prior to that, these people were housed often in state hospitals that had anywhere from 1,200 to sometimes 10,000, 12,000 patients in one state hospital on huge sprawling compounds. And there was really no treatment for these people other than to keep them housed and clean and safe and fed, which was a very valuable service to people otherwise who would have been homeless. What this new treatment did is allowed moving those people into the community. And there was a large government action to establish community mental health centers in the community that allowed us to treat and maintain these people in the community. Now, that is how it was established, and that was really the primary investment in the precursors, the organizations, community mental health systems that were here before Valley Mental Health. And these were largely government agencies. Some states do it as a state phenomenon. Here we've done it primarily administered through counties. But the commitment was to this very severe, persistent, chronic, disabling mental illness.
What then happened was the government enacted Medicaid, and it became entitlement insurance, providing mental health care to anybody who qualified based on their financial situations. The working poor, and many who were not working, qualified for Medicaid and were entitled to these services. More and more people who did not have serious mental illnesses then began to flood the system.
And in many ways, overwhelmed it, often with people who had emotional difficulties because they had horrific, difficult, challenging lives, but weren't really people who had clearly defined mental illnesses that were readily treated by sort of the sort of kind of standard effective mental health treatments we had for serious mental illness. That is a context that is never discussed.
Yeah.
And it is one of the foundational issues that must be addressed and are not being addressed.
The cost of providing government-based insurance like Medicaid became a more crucial issue, increasing pressure on bureaucratic leadership at the county, state, and federal levels to try to drive efficiency into that system. They began to micromanage every aspect, requiring loads of documentation expected faster and faster.
So increasingly, we were treating people who were not the sickest people, for whom our treatments had only a modest degree of benefit, even though they may have some benefit. And as a clinician, you take each patient and their pain and their difficulty and do whatever you can to try to help them. But in the process, began to squeeze out more and more the needs of people who had no real capacity to function in the community without not only medication, but a whole set of support services to maintain them in the community. And this really then is the fundamental crisis.
I was horrified that day.
This is the rest of the story of Kevin DeMoss's patient, who ran out of her medication and had to go to the emergency room.
As I thought about that and as I processed that information after she left, I thought to myself, what is happening to our system? Where are those services that we fund? These are taxpayer dollars that the county has. What's happening to those services? Why do these patients have to come and suffer and can't get access to health care that they deserve and that they've had? The providers have been cut, but the patients haven't been cut. We still have the same patient population and same patient load that we've had for years and years and years, but the availability of services for these patients has diminished greatly. I do not know where the money has gone. I see management with lots of money. I see decision makers that are doing very, very well. And then I see my patients who have to sit in the pharmacy for extended periods of time just to process the information on the cutbacks that they are having to deal with. But I only see the cutbacks on a patient level. I don't see those on a management level.
It's the wrong system. There may be very nice people. I've met people in this, and I think they're nice, well-meaning people, but it is the wrong construct for this population. I also think the Valley Mental Health has not adapted to it well, and we need a mechanism for rethinking mental health care in which the severe, persistent mentally ill are the first priority.
Optum has taken over the state Medicaid contract and is now overseeing Valley Mental Health. Next week, in part two of this story, we will hear from Optum and their proposed changes to the mental health care system, and explore how all the players, like Tim Whalen, foresee the treatment and quality of life for Utah's psychiatric patients.
First and foremost, they want to do what's right for the folks that are suffering with mental illness and addiction disorders, but secondarily, it helps us to avoid unnecessary costs in the jail and incarcerating folks in the jail that really they're only there as a result of their mental illness.
Thank you for listening.
Science Questions produced by Sherry Quinn and Susie Montgomery.
Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.
On the next Putumayo World Music Hour, we'll explore the danceable, lilting music that falls under the umbrella of Afropop. Music that fuses African traditions with Western rock, pop, blues, and jazz. I'm Rosalie Howarth. Join me for Afropop, the next Putumayo World Music Hour.
Friday night at 11 on Utah Public Radio.
Did you know that by repeatedly tasting fruits and vegetables, children can increase their liking of these foods? To accomplish this, parents should supply a fruit and a vegetable at lunch and dinner. Small incentives are a good way to promote initial and repeated tasting of these foods. As your child learns to enjoy fruits and vegetables, the incentives become unnecessary. Make it fun and you will make a difference in your child's food choices.
Did You Know That is made possible by the USU Emma Eccles Jones College of Education and Human Services. More at cehs.usu.edu.